We started last week talking about a particular kind of puzzle that seems to arise out of the existence of vague expressions in natural language, or vague forms of classification, vague concepts. And the basic form of the puzzle, this so-called Sorites puzzle or paradox, arises in the following sort of form. Have some case like premise one, one grain of sand doesn't quite make a heap. Premise two, we have what's known as a tolerance principle. This says that if you've got something that isn't a heap, making a very, very small change to that thing won't take you from something that isn't a heap to something that is a heap. Okay, and in this case, we characterise the small change by appeal to numbers of grains in the heap. So if you've got some specific number of grains in a non-heap and you add a single grain, you won't turn the non-heap into a heap. But we could have gone more fine grains, so to speak, at that point. We could have talked about half grains or whatever. All kinds of measures will enable you to get some kind of tolerance principle that's apt to look very plausible. It seems to follow, by appeal to ordinary classical logic, that if you have premise one and premise two, in effect, repeated applications of the universal generalisation in two will eventually take you to, for example, 10,000 grains of sand don't make a heap, 10 million grains of sand don't make a heap, and so forth for any quantity you like, which is apt to look absurd. So the first premise looks obviously true to most people. Second premise looks very, very plausible. And the third, the conclusion that seems to follow from those premises looks absurd and minimally very, very implausible. Okay, so starting with seemingly plausible premises and seemingly impeccable modes of reasoning, we arrive at seemingly implausible conclusions. So we know that that makes this a paradox. And as I said last time, as usual, the options available to us are the following. Right? We can't just... I guess in some sense we could just sit quietly with the result. Okay, we could, so to speak, accept that our thinking in this area, our thinking about heaps, and our thinking in other areas in which vagueness causes this kind of difficulty is just something we have to deal with. There's a way in which that's really just adopting one of the natural responses, the available responses, accepting the conclusion. Right? In that case, it's accepting that it's kind of a willingness to accept contradictions. Okay, bunch of things we want to hold. Or more minimally, it's accepting dramatic implausibilities. Right? So suppose accepting the result here is accepting there aren't any heaps, and perhaps that there aren't any tables, chairs, ball people, humans, and so forth. Right, insofar as those modes of classification are susceptible to similar kinds of argument. So one thing we could do is to accept some form of the conclusion, or accept that we just face a kind of puzzle here. Better response, it seems, would be to find a way of denying at least one of the premises. If we could deny one of the premises, refuse to assert one of the premises, and provide some justification for doing that, that would be a better way, I think, of avoiding the difficulties here. A different way of going would be to reject one or more of the forms of reasoning that are involved in generating the conclusion on the basis of the premises. So that would involve presumably some kind of revision or deviation from classical logic. And that might be forced on us by this puzzle, and it might be supported in other areas. There might be other bits of our thinking that we think aren't well modelled by the constraints and demands imposed on that thinking by ordinary classical logic of a kind that you pick up when you start doing philosophy. Pick up explicitly when you start doing philosophy. Okay, so as usual, we'd like a justified assignment of blame and ultimately also an account of how it is that we're misled by the argument. So, for example, if it's the tolerance principle that you want to give up, it would be ideal if you could not only explain why the tolerance principle should be given up, where it goes wrong, and what makes us think that's the right place to point the finger of blame, ideally, it'd be good if one could also explain why it so much as seems to us to be true, despite its being false. What gives this premise the patina of plausibility? What makes it seem acceptable? Okay, so I've said the crucial premise here seems to be the second premise. It's the one that isn't kind of obviously either correct or incorrect. It looks very plausible, but perhaps not trivially plausible, perhaps not absolutely secure. So the idea of the tolerance principle, as I've said, is that there are some predicates or concepts we make use of that seem to tolerate very small changes in the things that they either apply or fail to apply to. So if you've got one of these concepts, there are going to be at least some cases where the concept clearly applies, and then making a very small change to the thing that it applies to won't make this a case where the thing no longer applies, the predicate no longer applies. That's minimally, and then the tolerance principle generalises that and says in no case, however kind of tentative your view that the predicate applies in this case was, still, even in those tentative cases, if it's true that the predicate applies, if you really have a heap here, say, then making a very, very small change to the thing you're applying it to won't make a difference to that, won't take you from a case where the thing applies to a case where it doesn't yet.
And who coined the term tolerance principle? It's quite interesting.
God knows. It's possible that this derives from Carnap. Carnap had... And the reason I think that is because Carnap had a notion of tolerance, but I think used it in a different way. So Carnap's appeal to tolerance was bound up with the idea of being tolerant about other conceptual schemes, and in particular about other forms of logic, so other kind of broad logics governing one's conceptual scheme. So it may be that use derives... But it's very natural. I mean, it's such a natural expression for what's going on here.
Yeah. I guess not.
It's descriptive. Both cases just appeal, it seems, to the ordinary meaning of the expression, so it's not specifically technical. Okay. Okay, so, again, still recapping stuff we talked briefly about last time, the natural place to try to assign blame here is the tolerance principle. However, it's not entirely straightforward to assign blame there. Because if we deny the heap tolerance principle, it follows immediately that we get the following negation. It's not the case that for all numbers n, if n grains of sand don't make a heap, then n plus 1 grains of sand don't make a heap. So we get that negation. The most straightforward way of rejecting the tolerance principle is via its negation, accepting its negation. It's just false. But then in classical logic, that negation is equivalent to the existential claim that there exists a specific number n such that n grains of sand don't make a heap and n plus 1 grains of sand do make a heap. Okay, and that's obvious enough, but having the relevant claim put starkly like that is often enough to stop people from finding it credible. Okay, the idea that there is an absolutely sharp number, there's a fixed number, such that anything with that many grains of sand is a heap. If you take one away, you no longer have a heap. And so forth with respect to all the other cases where vagueness arises. There's a number of hairs, for example, such that if you have that many hairs on your head, you're not bald. But if you take one hair away, you move to baldness. Okay, and so forth for all of these cases of vagueness. So the worry is that although it kind of seems as though the most straightforward way of dealing with the paradox is to give up the tolerance principle, it's not absolutely straightforward to see how we can give it up. We don't, on the face of it, want to give it up by simply rejecting it, as we might in some other cases, simply saying that's false. Looks like we're going to have to do some slightly more fancy footwork to get ourselves in a position where we can see it as reasonable to give up that tolerance principle, if that's what we want to do. Okay, so straight denial of the tolerance principle appears to lead to straight assertion of the existence of absolutely sharp cutoff points. Many people when confronted with the phenomenology of vague expressions, the way we feel they apply or don't apply in various cases, and the domain over which we're just kind of hesitant either to apply or withhold application of those expressions, leads us to think that there aren't, or leads many people to think that there aren't absolutely sharp cut-off points, at least that it's implausible without more ado to assert that there are absolutely sharp cut-off points. Okay, so in particular, we're apt to think that we would be at a loss just off the bat to say where the sharp cut-off points are. Okay, we don't know where the sharp cut-off point between bald and non-bald is. Don't know how many hairs that would involve. But moreover, we don't really have the first clue about how we go about finding out. There are plenty of things we're ignorant of, but we kind of have a view about how we could go about finding those things out. In this case, it's just not clear what we would do. Okay, perhaps we'd have to look at how everyone uses these expressions or something. But even if we had all that information, we had some kind of consensus-bound way of characterising the uses people make of their expressions, it's not clear we'd have a clue how to feed that into a story about how that could generate a specific number, dividing the bald from the non-bald, the heaps from the non-heaps. Okay, so given that we have no clue where the relevant line is, it's a good question why we think we're entitled nonetheless to assert that there is such a line. And presumably it's something like that thought that drives people to find it very implausible that there is such a sharp line, despite what seems to be our principled ignorance about where it lies. So it seems on the face of it, it seems at least to many theorists in this area, right, you might want to reject this, you might think there are ways of replying, but it seems to many people that we should accept that we don't know where the sharp cut-off point is, and we cannot know where, if anywhere, this sharp cut-off point is. We just don't have a clue where to even start looking for where, for a location for this sharp cut-off point is. And if you agree to that much, then the question becomes, how should we explain this principled ignorance? Why is it that we don't know where the cut-off point is? And we've already seen that one kind of response, one very natural and plausible response is to try and explain why we don't know where the cut-off point is by denying that there is such a cut-off point. Okay. Say, do you know who the superhead of the Department of Philosophy is? Hands up if you know who the superhead of the Department of Philosophy is.
Well, I mean, the head is Matthew.
Right. So who's the superhead?
See, I don't know. There isn't one.
There isn't. Well, you don't know, right? No. Normally, you don't know. You don't have a clue how to answer that question. No. In this case, that's because there isn't one.
Yeah.
Point out. I mean, if there were, it'd probably be Cassim. but there isn't one. Okay. So there's no superhead, and that explains why you don't know who the superhead is. And similarly, in this case, a natural model is to try and explain why you have no clue where the sharp dividing line is by denying that there is such a sharp dividing line. Okay, but it's not the only way, perhaps, of explaining that. But until recently, that kind of mode of explanation has been the predominant account, for reasons that it's kind of natural. Predominant account of our ignorance, and the fact that we just don't know, has been that there's nothing there to know. There is no sharp cutoff point, hence there's no way of knowing the sharp cutoff. There's no fact of the matter, in some sense of fact of the matter, about where the cut-off point is. Now, if that's right, then in order to respond to the puzzle, we want to respond to the puzzle, but we're suggesting that there is no sharp cut-off point, so we can't make the most straightforward response to the puzzle, which is ends up in asserting there is a sharp cut-off point. We need a way of denying that there are no sharp cut-off points in order to resist the argument without thereby asserting that there is a sharp cut-off point. And it's not straightforward to see how to do that. There might be various different approaches. Okay, so the idea, very crudely, is something like this, some version of this idea, that our concepts and our predicates fail to determine answers to every question that can be raised about their application. Okay, so there are going to be cases where you get an answer, that's not a heap. Cases where you get an answer, that's a heap. And then a range of cases where the concepts you're deploying, the meanings of your expressions, fail to dictate one or another answer. in some good sense. Okay, in some cases, our concepts leave open whether or not they apply. So when this happens, we get one version of what's known as a borderline case. Okay, a case where we're unwilling to apply a concept and also unwilling to apply a negation of the concept. Okay? And the semantic account views borderline cases as what they appear to be. Right, so they appear to us to be cases in the sense that we don't know what to do. They appear to be to us to be cases in which our expressions neither apply nor fail to apply. It's not straightforward they apply, it's not straightforward their negations apply. And the semantic account treats that as revealing how things are with the relevant concepts. Other kinds of views might treat that as just an appearance, right? An appearance born, for example, of our ignorance. Okay, but this is a semantic account since it seeks to trace our ignorance to aspects of our concepts or our meanings. Okay, so it tries to explain what's going on here, not by appeal to the idea that there's some vagueness in the world, and not by appeal to the idea that there's no vagueness, it's just a matter of our ignorance. Tries to explain what's going on here by appeal to a kind of deficiency in meaning or a deficiency in our concepts. They fail to do something we might have expected our meanings or concepts to do. So that's one style of account. Another style of account, which I've alluded to already and mentioned last time, is one that says there are sharp cut-off points. So given that there are sharp cut-off points, we need some other explanation for our ignorance of where they lie. So our starting point was that we don't know where the sharp cutoff points are. So the reason for our ignorance has to be something other than there being no facts of the matter. It has to be something, in effect, to do with our capacities to know things. Okay? There's a fact of the matter, all right, on this kind of view, but something about us, or about knowledge in general, makes it so that it's impossible for us to know what those facts are. Okay? So ignorance is explained by something like general limits on where knowledge is possible, or perhaps general limits on where knowledge is possible for creatures like us, beings with the kinds of knowledge-gathering capacities and powers of discrimination that we have. It's a different kind of model. Right, I mean, it's very natural. I mean, not everyone will agree, but I think it's very natural to think there are tons of things that we don't know about the universe. Okay, and there are also tons of things that we can't know about the universe. Right? At least in principle, we have no reason to go beyond the judgment that there are things that we don't know about the universe and that, moreover, we can't know. I mean, there are specific kinds of cases where it's almost undeniable. Right, that there are facts that one can't know. Right, there are kind of standard, seemingly paradoxical cases of this kind. So, for example, you take a fact like some kind of conjunctive fact, like of the form P, and no one knows P. Okay, you've got a fact of that kind, then that fact will look to be unknowable. Straightforward fact, but it'll be unknowable. So suppose P is the number of books in my office. Okay, so there's some fact about the number of books in my office, and actually that fact is straightforwardly knowable, right? You can just boringly go into my office and count up the books, right? Modulo vagueness about where one book ends and another begins. Okay? But you can figure out what that fact is. But this conjunctive fact includes the fact that as things stand, no one knows. That fact, no one knows how many books are in my office. So in order to know that whole fact, that conjunctive fact, you have to know this bit, right? But if you know this bit, that makes this bit false. It becomes false that no one knows P. And you can't know falsehoods in the relevant sense. You can't know P if P's not the case. So all I'm doing is just pointing out that there are kind of plausible principled reasons for thinking there are going to be at least some things one can't know, and it's anyway massively plausible. It would be hugely immodest, I think, to assume that humans, the kinds of creatures we are, can in principle know everything. Right? Seems kind of unhumble. Okay, so that's the general claim, and then this claim just specifies that kind of general claim to the case of sharp limits. Why not think that sharp limits are amongst the things that creatures like us can't know about, despite the fact that they obtain? It's the general kind of line. I mean, it'd be nice to then have a more detailed, specific explanation for why this piece of ignorance arises. So this kind of view is often called an epistemic account or epistemicism. Okay, and you could get forms of epistemicism in other areas. Epistemicism is typically a view about vagueness, but one could be epistemicist in other areas. You've got some puzzle, say something like this, there's a solution to the puzzle, we just can't know what it is, right, and then go home. That would be one way of responding to all kinds of paradoxes in philosophy. But epistemicism in general is a view that tries to explain what's going on with respect to some domain of philosophy by appeal to something about knowledge and ignorance, rather than some kind of funky metaphysics, something weird going on in the environment. So this kind of view traces our ignorance to aspects of our epistemic powers, our powers to know about things, rather than trying to explain our ignorance by appeal to, for example, there being no fact of the matter. So, still recapping, in one respect, the epistemic account is more modest than the semantic account, right? Rests with what everyone agrees about cutoff points, namely that we don't know what to say about these cutoff points, without attempting to explain that by appeal to something about the world or about our meanings. Attempts to explain that point of agreement, our reticence, our hesitance, our feeling of ignorance, viewing it as indicating any kind of gap in reality. So you can see why it would be immodest not to take this kind of move, right? Say, oh, well, it turns out I just can't work out how many books there are in Guy's room. I've done my best, but it turns out I can't find it out. I get confused halfway through trying to figure out, right? So there's a case where I just can't do it. I can't count that high or whatever. But I don't like the idea that that's down to me and my epistemic powers, so I try and write what looks to be a problem with me into a feature of my environment, into a feature of how things are independently of me. I say, there's no facts of the matter about how many books there are in my office. If there are facts of the matter, right, surely I, of all people, would be able to figure out what that fact is. So there's a way in which that kind of move in general would be immodest. And the suggestion here is that it would be equally immodest here with respect, without special pleading, be equally immodest to think that the fact that we can't know where cut-off points are immediately shows that there can't be any. There must be no fact of the matter here. But in another respect, the epistemic view is less modest than the semantic account, because it goes beyond what we agree to, which is that we can't know, right? It adds to that this weird additional commitment that nonetheless there is a specific fact of the matter. And you might think that goes beyond what we should really commit to here, right? You might even think that there may be some kind of epistemic account that doesn't have both of those features, right? It seeks to explain our principled ignorance in part by refusing to commit to the idea that there is a determinate fact of the matter that we nonetheless can't know about. Okay, so general question here, which we discussed a bit in seminars, is it's very natural, at least as an immediate reaction to epistemicism, especially this component of the view that there is a determinate sharp cutoff point, it's very natural to wonder how our concepts and our words can fix absolutely sharp cutoff points, given that we're subject to principled epistemic limits with respect to their precise locations. Surely it has something to do with my use of the expression heap, or our use of the expression heap, that it applies or doesn't apply in one or another cases. Right? It's not like we came across heap as some God-given expression where some omniscient being had already set it up
as having the particular semantic powers it has. It gets its semantic powers from us, one way or another. Right? No one really knows how, right? But it looks plausible that it has something to do with what we do with these expressions. So there's a general form of worry, which is how could it be, given that fact about what's supposed to determine where, if anywhere, a sharp cutoff point lies, has something to do with us, the genuine puzzle about how what we do could fix a sharp cutoff point, given that we don't have a clue where it is, and it doesn't figure in it, and it thus doesn't figure in any straightforward way in our applications of the expression. Okay, so that's epistemicism and semantic accounts in general. Now I want to look at a bit more specifically versions of each, starting with supervaluationism. So it'd be very natural to expect that a semantic account, an account that tried to explain what's going on with respect to vagueness and thus deal with the Sorites' paradox by appeal to features of meanings, by the fact that they fail to determine sharp cutoff points in some way, would have to involve some kind of revision to classical logic. That's because if we reject sharp cutoff points, we're in effect allowing that there are cases where a vague predicate doesn't apply and where its negation doesn't apply either. Right? So we're in effect minimally giving up principle of bivalence, according to which any purported application of an expression either delivers a truth or delivers a falsehood. And just to see that a little bit more clearly, consider what would happen if we required, if we had it built into what we were doing, that all concepts and predicates are governed by principle of bivalence. So for all presented items X, either X is C is true or X is C is false, where C is things like heap or what have you, bald, etc. Then be forced, it seems, to accept sharp cutoff points, assuming that the relevant concept applies in some cases and fails to apply in others. Right, so assuming it works in the way we think something like heat works. So for each case along the Sorites chain, right, we go along from the clear non-heap, we move along aiming for the clear heaps. For each case along that Sorites chain, our concept's going to either apply or not apply. Okay, hence, given bivalence, at the first point at which that concept stops applying, right, be a point at which its negation comes to apply. So as soon as say you start with the clear heaps, and you work down the line from the clear heaps, smaller and smaller heap-like things, on the way to the cases where you've just got one grain of sand, the first point at which you stop applying the expression heap, right? So it's not true that the expression applies, will be a case where it's false that heap applies. Okay, so that will be a perfectly sharp cutoff point. So it looks as though if we're going to reject sharp cutoff points, we have to give up bivalence. We have to at least modulate bivalence. Was that hand?
Yeah. I was thinking about, like, if you do run the argument backwards, don't you? I mean, I'm not sure how relevant it is, but you end up with the reverse conclusion that every grain of sand is in itself a heap. Because you can say 10,000 grains of sand is a heap. For any number n grains of sand where n is a heap, n minus 1 will also be a heap. Mm-hmm. Then you get the conclusion that one grain of sand is itself a heap.
That's right. It'll look, insofar as running the argument one way is plausible, running it the other way will look plausible. It's one of the reasons why people find the idea that we could respond to the puzzle by simply accepting, say, that there are no heaps, implausible, because running the argument in the other direction will deliver up the result that there are too many heaps. Right? There could be issues there. One could reasonably adopt one or the other of those views, right? But one would need arguments, and on the face of it, it's a kind of case of something we talked about a couple of times, a worry about arbitrariness. Right, you need very clear grounds for thinking you should endorse one of these responses, except there are no heaps, rather than just accepting that there are tons of heaps.
But it's not out of the question that someone could provide such ground. Someone would need to press a bit harder to turn that into a decisive objection, I think. Okay, so if we're going to reject sharp cutoff points, it looks like we're going to have to give up bivalence, and it would be natural to expect that that would lead to further revisions of classical logic. But very roughly, in order to occasion such revisions of classical logic, further revisions of classical logic, the semantic revision, giving up the way that truth applies in particular cases, would have to lead to revision of some kind of base level logical claim. So in particular, the thought would be that if you give up bivalence, the claim that every claim is either true or false, that will lead to trouble with the law of excluded middle. Right, so that for all presented items X, either X is, say, a heap or X is not a heap. It's kind of base-level claim. Doesn't make any mention of truth or falsity. So the natural thought is we're going to respond to the puzzle by denying sharp cutoff points. We have to give up bivalence. And then that if we give up bivalence, that will lead us to give up the law of excluded middle and thus lead to a revision of base-level classical logic. But supervaluationism is a particular way of implementing the idea that we might try and avoid the sorites without thereby endorsing the existence of sharp cutoff points. And it has the rather neat property, nice property, of sustaining ordinary classical logic, including the law of excluded middle, while revising classical semantics by giving up bivalence. Okay, so it has this nice property that it keeps quite a lot of classical logic fixed. I mean, if you hate classical logic, you'll see that as a source of objection. But if you like classical logic, or you just prefer not to acquire competence with any other form of logic, then this would be a nice property. This would be something that might lead you to favour supervaluationism. And more generally, right, it's minimally disruptive. Right, so giving up bivalence and the law of excluded middle is more disruptive of ordinary thinking in this area than just giving up bivalence and finding a way of sticking with law of excluded middle, I think. And you might favour the least disruptive solutions to given paradoxes. Okay, so supervaluationism takes off from the idea that for certain purposes we might consider replacing a vague concept or expression with some kind of sharp concept or expression. I said in at least one of the seminars, maybe both, that you can think about this as kind of connected with things like Tarski's approach to philosophical problems. Right? So his kind of caricature of Tarski's approach is you're doing epistemology and you're trying to reflect on how knowledge works and you get to trouble and you think, God, skepticism shows that there's some deep incoherence in our ordinary concepts of knowledge. Bugger, right? And that's a moment where philosophers often kick in and start, you know, worrying about how we can save our ordinary concept of knowledge. Tarski's style of approach will be just to get shot of the ordinary commonsensical notion of knowledge and replace it with something designed to avoid whatever difficulty we got into with the ordinary notion. Then the idea will be that move will be minimally successful if we're both able to avoid the problems, the things that got us into trouble, and the replacement notion is able to do enough of the work we hope to do with the ordinary notion. Okay. Something like that figures here. So the crude initial move is, instead of dealing with vague expressions like he, which lead us into sorites trouble, we might instead consider using sharp expressions like collection of 1,000 grains of sand, collection of precisely 1,000 grains of sand. Get this idea, and that won't lead us into trouble, right? Because it's built into that concept that there's a kind of sharp cutoff point between something that's one of these things and something that isn't. But as I've said, we'd like our sharp replacement for heap to do roughly the same sort of work as was done by the vague expression that the sharp thing replaces. So we don't think that any old sharpening will do. There are going to be certain kinds of constraints on what counts as an acceptable or an admissible sharpening.
So, for instance, we won't want sharpenings that allow a single grain of sand to count as a sharp heap. Okay, that would be too out of kilter with our ordinary conception of what a heap is. And we won't want sharpenings that don't allow a pile of something like 10,000 grains of sand to count as a sharp heap, because again, that would be too out of kilter with our ordinary conception of what heaps are. So we get the idea, a broad idea of an acceptable sharpening. Slightly more precisely, the idea is that an acceptable sharpening will count as a sharp heap all piles of sand that definitely count as heaps. And it will count as not a sharp heap all piles of sand that definitely don't count as heaps, right? They definitely aren't heaps. But otherwise, there's freedom of play, right? The idea is that minimal condition of acceptability is just respecting the definite heaps and the definite non-heaps. That's the demand. And if you meet that demand, your sharp replacement will do much of the work that's already done by the notion of heap. So between the definite heaps and the definite non-heaps will be the kind of range of borderline cases, the so-called penumbra, kind of shadow, where things go a bit weird. Within the penumbra, any acceptable sharpening can count things either as sharp heaps or as non-sharp heaps. So you can get divergence amongst the various acceptable sharpenings. So, all acceptable sharpenings have to agree on the definite cases and the definite non-cases, but they can differ in the intervening penumbra. They can disagree about exactly where to draw their sharp lines. So we end up with a range of acceptable sharpenings for each vague concept or expression, right? Typically a lot of acceptable sharpenings. So you could have for heap, you could have things like heap 100 to heap 200, say. Supposing that if you've got less than 100 grains of sand, you've got a non-heap. If you've got more than 200, say you've definitely got a heap. But between 100 and 200, you just have a range of these absolutely precise sharpenings. Okay. And that's fine. So then heap 100 is given a semantics like this. It's true of a pile of 100 more grains of sand and false of a pile of less than 100 grains of sand, something like that. Heap 101 is true of a pile of 101 or more, false of a pile of lesser pile, and so forth for each of the specific sharpenings. That gives us truth conditions for each of the acceptable sharpenings of the ordinary predicate heap. Okay, so that gives us, we've got these technical notions, heap 101, heap 102, and so forth, and we know what it takes for those sharpenings to be true or false. And now we use that machinery to generate the supervaluationist treatment of our ordinary notion of heap. So the first idea here is that a use of an ordinary vague expression like heap is going to be super true, just in case it's true on every acceptable sharpening of the expression. Okay, so it comes out true with respect to all of its acceptable sharpenings. Second, a use of heap is super false if it comes out false on every admissible sharpening. And then we get that a use of heap is neither super true nor super false. It's a sort of super gap, just in case it's true on some admissible sharpenings and false on some admissible sharpenings. Right? In effect, if it falls in the penumbral zone. So within the space of definite truth for heap, ordinary definite truth, an expression is going to be super true since all of its admissible sharpenings, in order to be admissible, will have to count the expression as truly applying. So heap is definitely true, so super true when applied to piles of, say, more than 200 grains or more than 1,000 grains or what have you. Yeah.
I'm just a bit confused about the notion of admissible sharpening.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is just that it respects the clear cases of judgment in either direction. Okay. That's all that really matters.
Okay.
So what it does...
So is that those clear cases are the sharpening?
No, the clear cases are the cases where we know that we're absolutely clear this is a heap.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got all these heaps that are just huge, they're definitely heaps.
Yeah.
And over here you've got, individual grains of sand, definitely not heaps.
So there's kind of a space of true judgments and, where that person's clearly bored, there's kind of like a limit here, and then it's kind of like there, and like when you try and point there, you're like, well, it's not really obvious that we're actually getting it.
Exactly. The way of thinking is that we don't want to count something as a genuine sharpening of the concept of heat if it fails to respect our absolutely firm, robust judgments.
Yeah.
But then there's this range of cases where our judgments aren't absolutely secure or firm. Right, you and I might disagree, I'm going to be hesitant, I'm not sure, I don't really want to call that a heap, but I don't really want to say it's definitely not a heap either, I'm just not really sure what to say. Yeah.
Aren't you going to be getting exactly the same problem all over again at the age of
9? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep, good. I mean, well, I'll say a little bit more about that when we come to it, but that's right. Yeah.
I think 2 grains of sand is a heap, just a very small.
Okay, well then we disagree, so we're in the penumbra. Good, right, as long as they're stacked correctly. Okay, this is just to win out. This is now has to be my new example. I was saying, I think I only said this in one of the seminars. I had a student once who thought that 4 grains of sand was enough because you get kind of pyramid structure. So this is Tommy's attempt to kind of trump that guy. Okay, so, and similarly, right, within the space of definite falsehood, an expression is going to be super false, since all admissible sharpenings will count that as false. And between the definite truths and the definite falsehoods, an expression is going to be neither super true nor super false, because some of the admissible sharpenings are going to go one way, some are going to go the other way. So with respect to those penumbral cases, heap is neither definitely true nor definitely false, and so it's neither super true nor super false, in effect. And now, obviously enough, we exploit this machinery of super truth and super falsehood, given in terms of ordinary truth of sharpenings, in order to give an account of ordinary truth and falsehood for the target claims. So we identify ordinary truth with respect to heap, with super truth, and ordinary falsehood with super falsehood. And then we allow cases that are neither true nor false, neither super true nor super false, to be kinds of gaps. Okay, so, just a question here. How does supervaluationism avoid the sororities, given that structure? Any ideas? How to deal with the initial puzzle?
It says that there is a number where you add 1 to it and you then enter the realm of super truth. So there is a number where something is not definitely a heap and then you add 1 and it is definitely a heap.
Well, more carefully, it says that there are a range of cases where, I mean, I think that's true. But that's not a case where you slip from falsehood to truth, because there's no point where you get that. Okay, so remember, what you do is you go from truth to, in effect, neither truth nor falsity. And then over here, you go from neither truth nor falsity to falsity. Okay, so you don't get that kind of slip from truth to falsity. But what you get is this array of cases where the target sorority's claim, the relevant tolerance claim, comes out neither true nor false. That's the thought. Does that make sense? which is why it's not the straightforward denial. It's not the straightforward denial of cutoff points that we started with. Okay, so the idea is that the tolerance principle will come out neither true nor false in application to penumbral or borderline cases. Okay, so the particularly the individual conditionals that the tolerance principle embeds will have some true sharpenings and some false sharpenings. And that will mean that this argument isn't sound, right? The sorority's argument doesn't have, it isn't both valid and has entirely true premises. At least one of its premises will be neither true nor false. So for instance, this claim, if a pile of 150 grains is not a heap, then a pile of 151 grains is not a heap, will come out false on some sharpenings. Right? It will come out true on some sharpenings and false on some sharpenings, given the structure we've looked at. So this claim will be neither true nor false, so can't be exploited in a sound argument to the conclusion that there are no heaps. So in order to be problematic, at least on an ordinary understanding, the sororities has to at least be a sound argument. All of its premises have to be true. And this is a way of denying that all of its premises are true without asserting that some of them are false. Right? Some of them are just neither true nor false. So supervaluationism fairly clearly involves a denial of bivalence. Right, because there are some sentences or claims that come out neither true nor false. So that's not the case that every claim you have is either true or false. Some are in this borderline. But one of its most attractive features, or most attractive features to at least some theorists, is, as I've said, that this account's nevertheless able to retain the law of excluded middle, the principle that all instances of P or not P come out true. Can you see why that should be, given the structure of the account?
Because for each sharpening, it will either be true or not true.
Exactly. So for each sharpening, the relevant claim of this form with the sharpening on either side will come out true. Okay, so with this claim, claims of this form will come out super true, since true on every admissible sharpening. Okay. Exactly right. Yeah.
But then doesn't that restrict the law of excluded middle, so you can't talk about the vapor and you can talk about the sharpening?
No, you can talk about the... So you talk about the heap or not heap, okay, but in talking about that, you're talking about every sharpening. Okay,
right.
So, and each of the sharpenings will make this come out true. So it'll either make this side come out true.
Yeah.
So because each of the sharpenings will come out true, the thing as a whole comes out super true. So true. That's the model. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it has this odd pattern of properties. Denies bivalence, but respects the law of excluded middle. So every sharpening of this is a heap or this is a not heap will have to give the same sharpening of a heap here that it gives here. And that will deliver the result that on each of the sharpenings, the law comes out correct. So it comes out super true, and so we win. Okay, so the break for 10 minutes in a minute. I'll just list four attractive features, and I'll say perhaps a little bit more about these when we come back. Four attractive features of supervaluationism, or at least attractive to some people, are first up, it assigns blame to the sorority's argument. It says it's the tolerance principle that's to blame, but not because it's false, rather because it's neither true nor false. Its central notion, the sharpening, is modulo some issues about why certain sharpenings should be admissible or not. It's fairly intuitive. I mean, the idea of a sharp category is fairly intuitive, and one can see some kind of intuitive pull to thinking there's a connection between the notion of heap and each of these sharpenings. So that's a plus. It provides what seems to be a precise treatment of vague expressions, which is nice. And it retains classical logical principles, at least base level principles like the law of excluded middle. Right? Gives up bivalence, but that doesn't have the horrific effects on logic
that it might have in some other systems. Okay, so I'm going to pause for a 10-minute break. Come back at 5 past, please. Thank you.